Well, welcome everyone again. Shabbat Shalom. Welcome to the mountain. We're going to talk today about work and rest. What's the relationship between them? As I said, a couple of weeks ago, I went to this wonderful seminar that was really challenging, speaking about rediscovering the doctrine of work. What gives us our sense of self-worth? What gives us how do we express the divine image? Because what is the first thing we learn about God when he is introduced in the Torah? He's working, right? He works creating for 6 days. He does all of this creating, and then he sits down and he rests on the seventh day. And we're told that during that, he created Adam and Eve. He created them male and female, and he placed them in the garden, and he gave them work to do. And so we're gonna talk about that, but it's in the context of rest, strangely enough. The two are actually intrinsically related. And so hopefully we will see that. So this Torah portion, it's short. Maybe that's what our holidays are supposed to be, short, right? Because it's mostly about holidays, what we would think of as holidays. So just a real quick summary of that. It starts out with a description of the seventh year sabbatical rest that Israel is supposed to give the land. Speak to the children of Israel and tell them, when you come into the land which I give you, then the land is to keep a Shabbat to Adonai. And it ends in Leviticus 26:2 with, you are to keep my Shabbatot, my Sabbaths, and have reverence for my sanctuary. I am the Lord. Sometimes we often get lost in the woods with these kind of things. So what we're going to do is, after I finish describing this Torah portion in short, we're going to go back to the very beginning, to the creation story, and try to make sense of this work-rest conundrum that we often have, especially in our society. What's this dates me. I probably shouldn't even say this because it dates me so old, but remember the old advertisements, you know, weekends were made for Michelob? I don't even know if that company's still in existence anymore. I really don't do beer, so. But the whole idea is that we do things in order to take leisure. So ours is a society that is built around leisure. In fact, I used to play tennis with a guy who was a professor of leisure studies, of all things. Okay, so you can get degrees and spend your life teaching about how to bowl. Leisure studies, that's essentially what he was all about. And so this is actually a very, very big part of our society, leisure studies. We do things, we work in order to get the time off and the funds to be able to go have a good time. But is this the biblical picture? I'm not so sure that it is. In fact, I think we actually have it backwards. Our rest, as we're going to see, is actually work for the Lord. After the seven-year sabbatical, God then says, after the seven-year sabbatical, we do seven of those. And then on the 50th year, the beginning of the 50th year, on Yom Kippur, a shofar is sounded and it proclaims the year, the Yovel year. We say it's the year of liberty. And this is the year where all debts are canceled. Think about it. This isn't your 50 years and your 50 years, but it's on the same calendar. No matter where you are in Israel, if you're part of the kingdom, you participate on this particular calendar. So everybody celebrated the Sabbath on the same day of the week. Everybody celebrated the seventh year sabbatical in the same year, and then everybody celebrated the Yovel, or the year of Jubilee, at the same time. So the whole country would take a break. They were supposed to take a break, okay? If you read the whole Haftorah portion of Jeremiah, it's actually pretty depressing. He says the siege gates are outside the city right now because none of my commandments my people have kept. And this was a big one. God said, the land is to have its rest every 7 years, and every 50th year, the land has another rest. So you have the seventh year, and then you have another year of rest. So it's like an extra year. So you have this long rest, and everything reverts back to its beginning. And we had an interesting discussion last night in our small group about this. So at the end of 50 years, everything reverts back to its original state. God just hits the reset button, and everybody goes back to their ancestral land. So tribe community is important in God's eyes. We still stay connected to our people one way or another. We may have moved away, a long ways away. Maybe you lived in the Negev, way down there in Eilat. I don't know, doing cruises for people in the Red Sea, right? Or maybe you lived in Naharia, which is, anyone ever heard the name Naharia before? You've been there. Yeah, okay. That's where George and Karen and Clay and Vic went to, Naharia. It's about as far north as you can get in Israel. It's just 4 kilometers from the Lebanese border. Maybe you're there, and I don't know, you organize hikes to the Golan Heights or something like that. We read about that in the travelogue of Vic Annis, right? But at the end of 50 years, all of that goes away, and you go back to the land of your family, and everything starts over. All debts are released, and you all go back, and everyone is set free. So if you were in servitude to someone, that is all done with. No matter how long it's been, it's all done with, and we all go back to our ancestral lands. Do you realize that in the United States, we don't do things like this? We actually have a... I think we think of it as more just, but I'm not so sure it is. We don't do indentured servitude. We don't do that kind of slavery. We decided that that is a bad thing. So what do we do instead? We have bankruptcy. So you get a good lawyer and you stick it to the person that you owe money to. And you walk away, and I know people who are very good at doing this. They're serial bankruptcy people. They get into debt, they get all this stuff, and then they file bankruptcy, and they're able to, either for their company or for themselves, and they're able to go on as they were and never end up having to pay their debts. God had a different picture. He said, if you get into debt and you can't do things, you end up working for the person you owe money to. But it's not forever. How long was it? Did anyone read carefully? Up to 6 years. It could be only 2 years, but it could be as many as 6 years, because on the seventh year, those debts are canceled and the servants go free. Okay, but in the 50th year, it's like a large thing where the whole country does the same thing, and then everyone goes back to their ancestral land. This was one of the passages that helped convince me when I was a very new believer that the Bible really was of supernatural origin, because from a human perspective, these commandments are really stupid. I want to use that term. They seem absolutely senseless, because what happens if there's a drought in the sixth year? Because God said in the sixth year, you produce like normal. He said, but I will command a blessing. And in the sixth year, it will produce enough for essentially 3 years, the sixth year, the seventh year, and the eighth year, because it's only on the eighth year that you start planting again. So really, for that seven-year period, the end of that, we have to trust God actively for 3 years of blessing, and it has to be at the right time. It can't be in the third year, because he said, you can't store this up. So in the sixth year, we have to trust him that the seventh year and the eighth year, that he will provide for us. And so it's like God is saying, I will command a supernatural blessing if you listen to me, if you follow me and trust me. And of course, we have this picture also in the New Covenant Scriptures. The Messiah said, why do you worry about tomorrow? and your clothing and your food and all that you need. This is in Matthew chapter 6. He said, doesn't God provide that for all of those? He said, but seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and then all these things will be added to you. So God is telling the people of Israel that the land belongs to me, not to you. Okay, that's another commandment in here. It doesn't belong to you, it belongs to me. And you are stewards and servants on the land. And what I want you to do is learn to actively trust me. That's what we're going to go back and look at. The whole of the Torah is all about God preparing a people so that he can live with them and show his light throughout all the nations. Okay, so let's back up a little bit. Let's go back to the creation story. Let's go back to God building this beautiful garden, because I believe that the seventh year and the 50th year imagery that while living in the land we're supposed to participate in, this was supposed to be a picture to the nations of what the kingdom of heaven looks like. So we know, if you read Genesis chapter 1, that there are two major themes in Genesis chapter 1, the creation of the world. There's this theme of light and darkness and the separation of those two, right? And from this, especially after the fall, we get this consistent picture of two worlds. We have the world of sin and death. Paul speaks extensively of that in Romans. On my one hand, I serve the law of sin and death. On the other hand, I rejoice in the law of God. There's the world of sin and death. There's the kingdom of heaven. The kingdom of heaven is associated with light, the presence of God. There's no darkness in the kingdom of heaven. God himself is the light, and we see this, of course, in Revelation 21 and 22. When the New Jerusalem is there, it's like a restoration. God is now once again there, and we are enjoying his presence, and we don't even need sun or moon. Not to say that they're not there, but we don't need them because he himself is our light. There is no darkness where God is. On the other hand, in the world of sin and death, what is it characterized by? Darkness. Not God's presence. His presence is not there. I know the Bible says that wherever we go in the world, God's presence is there, but he also tells us there are certain places that he's not. He's not in the company of the arrogant. We won't find him there. Where do we find his presence? In the humble, the brokenhearted, those who are poor and needy, who look to him. He raises them up, the psalm says, from the dust heap, and places them on high places, and he's with them. God is not found in the world of sin and death. It's a place of darkness. And the whole Bible, the rest of the Torah, now speaks of this world of sin and death. Genesis, in particular, speaks of that, the world of sin and death, and the end of the first Torah portion, as we're getting ready to read about Noah. How does it end? It's pretty devastating. And the earth was filled with violence, and everything had become corrupted before God. Human nature was displaying its full expression. The world was filled with violence, everything was corrupted, and God saw and there was no one there. And then he said, but then there's Noah. We're going to look at that, his name, in just for just a little bit here. So before all this happened, Genesis begins with a very beautiful account of the creation and of God providing Adam and Eve, or Chava, a lifelong, actually, he intended it for to be an eternally long vocation, living in the garden and working. And this is what he said. Then God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness. Let them rule over the fish of the sea, over the flying creatures of the sky, over the livestock, over the whole earth, and over every crawling creature, flying creatures of the sky, the livestock, over the whole earth that crawls on the land. God created mankind, humankind, in his image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. Then he blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and multiply. Fill the land, conquer it. Rule over the fish of the sea, the flying creatures of the sky, and over every animal that crawls on the land. But in doing so, he also gave this commandment. Then God blessed the seventh day and he sanctified it, for on it he ceased from all his work that God created for the purpose of creating. And of course, we remind ourselves of that, hopefully every Friday night when we light the candles, when we pray the prayers, and this is one of those where we bless God for the creation. Thus, the heavens and the earth were finished on the seventh, on the sixth day. The heavens and the earth were finished. And we recite this passage as a reminder that we rest in God. So the picture here is that I want us to see is that God designed us for work. Okay, rest is actually a part of that work. The Garden of Eden was designed to be a sanctuary, and in it, God gave Adam and Eve rest. Genesis 2:15. This is very interesting because most versions, most English versions, and I had not seen this before, but most versions in English say something like this: "And the Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden in order to cultivate it and to watch over it." Okay. But if you read the Hebrew very carefully, it actually says this, and the TLV, I think, gets it right. The TLV puts it this way: "Then Adonai Elohim took the man and gave him rest in the Garden of Eden in order to cultivate it and watch over it." Do you hear that? God is actively associating rest. The Hebrew word for that is nuach, okay? It's a yod nun chet, okay? Yanach, actually, in the hefil, which is the same root for the noun noach, which means, what does Noah mean, you Hebrew students? Rest or comfort, depending on how you read it. And that same root is used for rest and comfort. The word nachem comes to mean comfort, okay? And that's the root of Noah's name, which is deficient. It's only two letters. If you add a mem, it becomes nachem, which means comfort. But it also means rest. And in fact, in the Torah, like, for example, when God talks about giving your donkey rest on the Sabbath, that same word is there that is used in this portion here. So God makes an association, a positive association between rest and working for him. When we work for him, we're resting. Do you see that picture? When we're working for God, when we belong to him, he gives us rest. And in fact, all through the Bible, we see these passages. In Jeremiah 16, I believe it is, the Messiah actually spoke of this in Matthew 11 when he said this. He said, "Come to me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest." Then what does he say? "Get your beach towels out." No, wait, that's the wrong version. That's the Florida version, right? "Get your beach towels out and just relax and put your sunglasses on." No, he says, "Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls." That is a direct quotation from a passage in Jeremiah where God says, "I told you, I gave you ancient signposts, I gave you guideposts, I gave you commandments that if you followed them, you would find rest for your souls." But then he says, "But you would not." And so because of that, we get the consequence of Jeremiah, which was to bring judgment on Israel. For how many years were they supposed to go into exile? 70 years. And what's the significance of those 70 years? For 490 years, they never gave the land the rest. They never listened to God. And so all of this that we read about in Leviticus 25 has never been practiced in Israel, as far as I know, even to this day, has never been practiced in Israel. So the world has not seen what happens when a people are God's servants and they see themselves as that. So here's a question. When we work, are we slaves to our work? Or is work our servant in order to serve God? Do we use the things that we do in our daily life as our servant in order to be spreading his word, in order to be a light to the nations, in order to be able to talk to people about why are we different? Why don't you go water skiing all weekend like everyone else does or whatever you do around? I don't know. Do people water ski? There's no alligators here, so we don't water ski here, I guess. I come from the far north. I come from Idaho, where you can usually see all the way to the bottom of the lake, so you know there are no alligators. And so so we did a lot of water skiing, even in the winter when it was really cold, but I wore dry suits. I'm one of those who originated this polar bear plunge on January 1st, go water skiing off the ice at Lucky Peak. That was not very smart. Do we in our lives, do we see our work as an expression of the rest that we have in Messiah? Or do we see it as a means to another end? We may not notice it, but other people do. If they see us as just working to accumulate wealth in order to have a good time, they'll look and they'll say, there's no difference between you and me. That's what I do. But if our very work, our very vocation becomes something that pleases God, becomes something that is done in his servant in order not to accumulate wealth, not to accumulate that second vacation home. I have a picture of one from Louisiana, my vacation home. It's a little tiny hovel with some guy sitting out there on a wicker chair. I don't have very big aspirations. Do we see wealth as something that we do, work to do, to get something, or do we see it as a vocation in and of itself? God put Adam and Eve in the garden in order for them to have rest. And in doing so, they would fill the earth. There are three commandments that he gave them before anything else. Fill the earth. That's really the first commandment. Multiply. Have children. Cultivate the earth. Conquer it. Cultivate it. And guard it. That's what the watch over, it means shomer, means to guard. So we oved, we work, we are fruitful and we multiply. We work the land. We conquer it. We're masters of the land. God intended for mankind to control the earth. And he's never relinquished that responsibility. But something happened, okay? We're to guard the creation, but something happened in the fall. We gained our own knowledge, not God's knowledge. We no longer have to go to God to know right from wrong. And the rest of human history, the world of sin and death, is dominated by which tree? It's not the tree of life. It's the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So if we shorten that a little bit, what has mankind sought ever since? Knowledge. That's been a part of my life. I have advanced degrees because I seek knowledge. And I teach it, I've taught at universities because I seek knowledge. That's a part of who we are. We want knowledge. It's a broken expression of something that God has put in us. He wants us to have knowledge. But where does he want us to go to have that knowledge? To his word. This is why the Torah is the central part of Jewish worship. Because that's where we gain our knowledge of right from wrong. That's where we gain our knowledge of how do we live. That's where we gain our knowledge of how we relate our work to his work. So if you think about it in the 50th year, in fact, this question was asked last night. Well, what if I'm living in Tel Aviv somewhere and I got a pretty good empire going? I just built a skyscraper, okay? And I'm not from there, but I'm way down south in the Negev. That's where my family came from. I don't know where I came from. I'm just a schmo. So I'm not really sure where my ancestral land would be there. But what would happen? God said, that's not what we're about. Our work is not about building empires. Our work is not about acquiring things and land and all of that sort of thing. Our work is about serving him. And in fact, he says this in this passage. He said, the land is not yours, it's mine. And you are stewards on it. And I can take it away from you. This is a hard thing, maybe for especially Jews who are what's our national anthem? I know it's the hope, but it's also Arza Aleinu, our land. Okay? It's our land. It's not our land. It's God's land. And he says, you're stewards on it, and I can take it away from you. There are a number of parables, a number of stories, especially in John, where the Messiah tells the religious leaders, this isn't yours, because they said, let's kill the son, because here he comes, and when we kill him, we can take title to everything, and the kingdom will be ours. God said, it's not yours. We're stewards. When we work for him. And that picture at the end of 50 years is a picture that's supposed to remind us of this, that it belongs to him. All of our work is not to build empires. All of our work is to build a kingdom. We're building the kingdom of heaven, and we're ambassadors for him. And so God reminds us at the end of 7 years, at the end of 50 years, and the end of 7 days, that all of this really belongs to him. And if we're properly resting in him, we're doing work for him, and we see all of our work as service for him. So I would challenge you. Do you see your work as, and all of your busy schedules, if you're like me, I had 5 kids. We finally exiled them all, almost. Aaron's still here. They're all grown now, and they moved out on their own. We didn't kick any of them out, so it was self-exile. And they moved to really, really strange places. One lives in Washington. Two live in Idaho. And a couple of them are still in Kentucky, but they're trying. So, but someday, the 50th year, God will call them all back, and they've got to come back home, wherever that is. Do we see work as it's our master with our busy schedule, or do we see our busy schedules as servants, a tool that we use to advance God's kingdom in our lives and in the lives of those around us? If we see work, if it's our master, we're just like Israel, who never rested in the land. And we tend then to see things as, this is an empire that I'm building, and it becomes something that's mine. Beware lest you say, my hand made all of this, all these wonderful things. God gave them that warning also in Leviticus. Don't say that, because God says, I can take it away from you. We need to be servants of God, not of our work. Because when we do that, then our very work becomes rest. Let us be therefore diligent to enter that rest, so that no one will fall through following the same example of disobedience. God designed us to work. And our very rest in him is a vocation. So when people ask us what we do, it's appropriate to respond with a vocation. It's probably most appropriate to say that, kind of like Jonah did when he was pressed. Remember Jonah? He was a fisherman. Well, no, he was the bait. I'm sorry, I got that backwards. He wasn't a fisherman. He was the bait. Okay, but he's on this ship, and it's going as far away from where he was told to go by God. And, you know, all this terrible stuff happened, and the sailors are throwing everything overboard. They're sacrificing to their gods, and they're running around looking for people who's at fault, because someone's got to be at fault for this. And they find Jonah, and ultimately they find out that he's the one that's at fault. And what was his response? They said, who are you? And he said, I'm a fisherman. No, what did he say? He said, I'm a Hebrew, and I fear the God of the Hebrews. And they went, oh, we've heard about that God. That's how we should identify. I'm a servant of the King of Kings. That's my vocation. And whatever I do should be focused on building his kingdom, because that's what God called us to do. And if we don't, we end up in slavery, because we end up working for things that don't last. Don't put your hope in things that rust, the Messiah told us. But put your treasures in heaven. And heaven is where his people are. We invest in people's lives. We don't invest in things. I don't care how many snowmobiles you have. People don't have them around here, but we grew up with them. That's how you get around in the wintertime, with snowmobiles. People don't have a lot of those. We should have ties to people's lives. Where's my treasure? Where do we put our money? Where do we put our efforts? Our time, our treasures, our talent, where do they go? They should go into his kingdom. Because God says, I'm going to take this all away. There's going to come a time where I'm going to say, now you go back and you rest and you recharge and you listen to me for a whole year, and then everything starts over. You don't go back to your empire. Everything starts over. We should have that same attitude. So what happened? Just real shortly, when we're reading the Torah, I kind of want us to have this overall picture. There are three really important threads in the Bible that we need to understand if we're going to understand the Bible and our role in resting in Him and working for God. The first I've already talked about, the world of sin and death and the kingdom of heaven. Most of the world is in the world of sin and death. The kingdom of heaven is wherever God's people are. And that's what this picture of Israel was supposed to be, the land was supposed to be. It was supposed to be an image for the rest of the world of what the kingdom of heaven is like. What is life like when God is in our midst? We are citizens of the kingdom of heaven. Not of Israel, not of the United States, not of wherever. We're citizens of the kingdom of heaven, and it doesn't have geographical boundaries. Its boundaries are where His people are. And we see this. So that's one thread that we read all throughout there, those two worlds and people that are in those worlds. The second important thread that starts out with the fall. What happened? Adam and Eve fell. They ate from the tree of life. And I only mentioned this briefly, but it's in a very important theme because you can't understand Leviticus without this theme. They were without clothes, and they were walking with God in the garden. There was no shame. There was nothing to hide. They were in His presence. They saw Him in ways that no one on earth, not even Moses, experienced. Moses could not see God. He could only see his backside, as God said. Okay, he could not be in the unmitigated presence of God without dying. No one can see me and live. So God says, I'll cover you. And then you'll see some of my glory when I pass by. But even Moses didn't have the full presence of God. Not so with Adam and Eve. They had His full presence there. And they didn't have clothes. And of course, when they fell, what's the first thing that they did? They hid themselves. That's the story of the world of sin and death. We're hidden from God. We don't know Him. And we can't see Him. I know the heavens declare the glory in Psalm 19, but this version in our Siddurah, I think, is a very accurate version. The voice is not heard. God's presence is not detected by most people in the world of sin and death, either because they suppress it or because they just can't see. And God needs to open our heart and our eyes to be able to see His presence. So we need to come back to His presence. We need a certain type of clothing. And of course, that's a whole other sermon and story in and of itself. We need a certain kind of clothing. It's interesting that the Bible begins with this, and it ends with the same thing. It was given to her in Revelation 19:8 to clothe herself. Who is the her? This is the bride, the wife of the Lamb. To clothe herself in fine linen, bright and clean, for the fine linen is the righteous acts of the saints. See that connection? What does righteous acts mean? That's what we do when we rest. That's the vocation that we have. We work for God, and He gives us rest. And He says, in doing so, I give you clothing so that you can now be in my presence. Blessed are those who wash their robes so they may have the right to the tree of life and may enter by the gates into the city. The kingdom of heaven now is filled with people who are clothed properly. That's what the sacrifices of Leviticus are all about. And so as we read through the Torah, Genesis is essentially a story of the world of sin and death, where it all went wrong. And then God says, in that darkness, I started with Noah, and then He went to Abraham, and then He got all the way down to Joseph. Genesis doesn't cover as many generations as perhaps it could have, okay? From Abraham to Joseph was what? Four generations is all. Okay, and it ends with Joseph. He's in Egypt. They're in darkness. They're in slavery. They're not learning the right kind of work, and they brought that upon themselves. Yes, we know that God's sovereign hand was leading them down there because of Him working through Joseph, but they were going into slavery, and a lot of it was their own doing. If they hadn't done all these things to Joseph, well, God would have found another way. Okay, So they're there of their own doing, and it's slavery. Genesis ends on a pretty bleak note, if you think about it. Then Exodus comes, and what are the two major themes in Exodus? Really, it's one theme. Okay, if someone were to ask you, what are the major? This is your test for the week. Professor Rod's going to bring out the test here. What's the short version of Exodus about? Mm-hmm. And then the rest of it is about building a tabernacle. I'll actually say that once the release happened, the redemption happens, Exodus 6:6, those four promises that we learned about in Passover, I will set you apart, I will deliver you from Egypt and from all those diseases, I will redeem you, purchase you, and I will be your king. I'll be your God and you'll be my people. He sets us apart, and he begins to build his tabernacle. Okay, so we have actually two tabernacles that are being built in Exodus. The first tabernacle is the important one. It's God's people. Peter puts it this way. You also, as living stones, are being built up, right, into a house, a temple, that is suitable for the very dwelling place of God. And so the physical tabernacle really is a picture of two others. It's a picture of the heavenly tabernacle where God dwells, but it's also a picture of God's people. We are being built together into a place where God actually lives. And that's what Exodus is really all about. So Exodus ends with this this wonderful picture where God comes and he fills the tabernacle with his glory, and the very end of Exodus says something pretty sad. Moses couldn't even enter into it because the glory of the Lord was there. No one can come into God's presence but when his glory is there. So that's what Leviticus is all about. How do we come into God's presence? It's through sacrifice. And this is where we begin to learn of that picture of the Messiah that started actually back in Genesis 3 when Adam and Eve fell and he said, the land is now cursed because of you, but the enemy who brought the curse, he'll be even more cursed, and God will provide one who will crush his head. That's where that promise began, and we see this most clearly in Leviticus. God provides for his people to now once again enjoy his presence. It's there. Now he's going to prepare us to live in his presence. That's the picture of resting in God, is we now have his presence in our very lives. And so Genesis, Exodus, and Leviticus, it's kind of the world of sin and death happens. Now we have God starting to build his people, the people of Israel, which is now a consistent thread through the rest of the Bible. The people of Israel are those people. God will dwell with us, and we now are the representation of the kingdom of heaven to those in darkness. And if people want to come into the kingdom of heaven, how are they going to get there? Salvation is from the Jews, Messiah says in John chapter 4. Salvation is specifically in the personification of Israel, the Messiah himself. There is no other way. And if we don't recognize that, in all of our vocation and our work, we'll lead people to the wrong doors. Because we'll say, oh, there's 5 ways to heaven. There's 10 ways. There's any number of ways. And I will admit, there are many paths out there in the world. But they don't lead to God. They actually end up leading in the other place. And you don't know it until you're there, because there's a way that seems right to a man, but its end is the way of death. We want to be on that path that leads to God. And that's what the people of Israel are about. That's what this 7th year and 50th year sabbatical is all about, teaching us that we belong to him. So how does this fit with us today? What about today? We can't go. You should be happy. I have like 80 pages of notes, and I'm not going to get through all of them. I have a really wonderful relationship with this church where I do regular teaching. We have a teaching team, and we have to be ready on the Tuesday before Sunday for the sermon, because we have to submit it to the others in the teaching group, and then they cut it all up and tell us. That's really stupid. It happens with me a lot anyway. think about this way, you know, that sort of thing. So I'm ready, but we don't have that discipline here. So I wasn't ready on Tuesday for this. Usually I get to go through that twice. I have overheads and all of that. But here are questions that I would like us to ask. Otherwise you may say in your heart, my power and the strength of my hand made me this wealth. But you shall remember the Lord your God, for it is he who is giving you the power to make wealth. This is Deuteronomy 8, verses 17 and 18. You shall remember the Lord your God, for it is he who is giving you your power to make wealth, that he may confirm his covenant, which he swore to your fathers, as it is to this day. Our task is not to build wealth. We don't look at all the neat things that we have done and say, this is for me. We have to recognize that it's God who has endowed us with everything. He's the one who set Adam and Eve in the garden and said, the world is your plaything. Well, it's your vocation. He set us in the kingdom of heaven by virtue of us trusting in the Messiah and coming into his presence and being his children. He's now given us that same task. We are now to take the kingdom of heaven and live in it the way he wants. And everything that he gives to us is now in servitude to him. So do we practice in our lives those kinds of relationships with our work and with people? Do we really understand that everything we own and do actually belong to God? Do we actually trust him for our sustenance? Do we trust him enough to say, I'm going to live the way that he said? Or do we hold back and say, you know, I like seven of the commandments, but the one about stealing, the one about being honest, I'm not going to do that. Do we give him everything, or do we just give him part of our lives? That's a question I think we should be asking on a daily basis. Do we actually rest in him? Do we see all of our labors and our work as truly belonging to him? Or do we see it as belonging to us, and God now owes me because of all the hard work that I've done? Do we actually see ourselves as completely belonging to him? Do we actually rest in him and see our life vocation as an expression of that rest? God put Adam and Eve in the garden and he gave him rest and said, now go do all this stuff. Do we see our labors for God as resting in him? If we do, I can tell you it's joyful. It's exciting because you wake up in the morning and you say, what can I be doing for God today? How am I going to see God working in my life? If not, it's you start worrying because someone's going to take something away, and I've worked hard for this, and it belongs to me, and I deserve it. You see the difference in attitude. If we trust in him, he's the one that everything belongs to, and we're working for him. I didn't really talk about it much, but Israel, as being in that place between the kingdom of heaven and the world of sin and death, we're the ones who go into the darkness and pull people out. There are three relationships that Israel has, okay, and we learn about those. The first relationship, of course, is with God. We have a relationship with God. The world does not. They don't know God. They're like in Egypt. If you lived in Egypt, you had, I don't know, how many thousands of gods and idols to worship because they didn't understand. They knew God was there, so what they did is they worshiped the creation instead of the creator. We have that special relationship with the God of the universe. He speaks to us. We perceive him. We, of all people, have a sense of his presence. He who has seen me, the Messiah said, has seen the Father. By living in the Messiah, we experience the presence of the Father. It all leads to his glory. We have that relationship. Do we practice that in our lives? Do we develop that relationship with God that we have that incredible privilege to do? But I'm going to go so far as to say that's not the most important relationship, as if you can have levels of important. The second relationship, which this Torah portion is all about, is our relationship with our family, with our friends, with the kingdom of heaven. How do we relate to one another? What did the Messiah say? All men will know, all of humankind will know that you're my disciples if you what? Love one another. Not work, not build empires, but love one another. How we treat one another becomes a picture of us presenting ourselves to the nations. And I will go so far as to say that the third relationship is actually what God created us for as believers in the Messiah. And that's our relationship with those on the outside, the foreigners, those who are in the world of sin and death. Our relationship with God empowers us if we have a proper relationship with Him. We have His Word, we have His Spirit, we have His very presence. The fullness of God actually dwells in our midst and in our lives. And that empowers us to love one another. Quite honestly, not all of us are as lovable as others. Okay? But that's not what God said. He didn't say, you know, love some people more than others. Even your enemies, we treat as if they're family. We love one another. And what that does is it empowers us to go to the outside and represent God to the nations. If we don't have those two things, we're not effective in reaching to the nations. We just end up looking like the nations instead of being a light to them. So God gives us His relationships in order that we would do His work, which is to be a light to the nations. And I would pray that we recapture here at Baruch HaBa that sense of urgency. We're working for God in order to bring light into dark places. We have people from our congregation that are in Israel. I'm sorry to say, but Israel is the world of sin and death. Just like every other place. It's one of the most secular places on the face of the planet. It's the world of sin and death. And those believers in the land should be shining in such a way that their communities show the love of God and the presence of God through His miraculous intervention in their life, through their love for one another. When you have Arabs and Israelis worshiping together, which we've heard about if you've been following these logs, they worship together. God can break down all these barriers of hatred. Do we love God enough? Well, do we practice those three relationships with a sense of purpose? Do I have a relationship with God so that I can learn to love my family and have a love for those on the outside so that I know how to reach them when they ask questions? How can we answer their questions? How can we interact with them in such a way that they will see God in our lives and come to love Him as well? I believe that that's what God created us for, and that's what our vocation should be. Can we recognize the difference in those two worlds in our life? We live in the kingdom of heaven, but guess what? We're right in the middle of the world of sin and death. And if in our lives we can't tell the difference between those two, we have some problems. So I would ask you to consider, how do we relate to people? How do we relate to God? Do we actually see our life as rest in Him? Let's stand for prayer.